Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Aparita de sangamata satavara ye sorvanta pamunjantu satang. So this afternoon, a chance to reflect on Dhamma, the way it is. So this is, I like to think, like this winter retreat opportunity to really contemplate the way it is, meditate on it's like this, whatever is happening to you, whatever state of mind you happen to be experiencing in the moment, it's like this. And rather than always saying it's my feeling or my emotion, always claiming ownership of what you're feeling in the present moment. Because that just reinforces the illusion of a separate self. This is a way of training ourselves to stop just operating from conditioning, from ego, from cultural conditioning, because that's how we're programmed to think in terms of experience is me, I'm experiencing this moment. And then when I first began to contemplate the way it is, I began to think, I don't know how it is. How do I describe this moment? And so I start trying to imagine, find feelings or something to say about the way it is. I remember going on retreats where they do this body sweeping practice. They go Inca type retreats where you go from the crown of the head to the soles of the feet and back up. And then you do the full body reflection on the full body experience, and I just, at first, just that absolutely baffled me. How can I can imagine, I can go to the top of my head, or my right arm, left arm, go through the thumbs and fingers on the right and left hand, go down the chest, the back, the buttocks, the genitals, the right leg, left leg, toes, and on like that. But when it came to reflecting on the whole body, you know, because I was always looking for an object, and I always considered, you know, the illusion was that I was doing this kind of scanning. I was observing the sensations on the top of my head and on down to the soles of the feet. That kind of illusion is me doing it. It's my practice. And then suddenly I had this insight, you know, to have the whole body image, you have to let go of everything. There's no, you know, just to try to see the whole body in one glance, you can't do it. where your right hand or left hand is quite obviously easy to be an object to notice. So these are conundrums or doubts that arise. You know, what does he mean the way it is? Benyang Niang in Thai. And the great Thai teacher Buddhadasa, Chakun Buddhadasa of Suan Mok, years ago, he was always talking about Benyang Niang, the way it is at this moment, not about in terms of words or qualities or conditions, but it's a way of opening rather than trying to see my whole body in some kind of imagined state. Just this empty, open awareness, I began to recognize the body is in the awareness, the whole body's in awareness, not in my brain, not as an object of me that I can get a good, make into a understandable object I can imagine or think I'm doing it. So these are ways of investigating experience, because as I've said many times, experience is here and now. So the present moment, now this is what we're experiencing, this moment is like this. And how many of you can say exactly, you know, have the right word equivalent meanings to describe this moment the way it is? But there's a kind of openness in this suggestion. Kind of, it suddenly stops the thinking mind, because you can't, the words don't come very easily. You can try to write poetry or try to describe it in poetic terms or scientifically or whatever, but that's playing games with words again. So this is very important for, you know, which I keep reminding you during these reflections on the illusion that consciousness is in your body rather than your body's in consciousness. So that's an enormous shift. Because we're conditioned to think that consciousness is the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, the brain, and all these are what consciousness is about. Sensory consciousness. So the senses are vehicles for consciousness to see, hear, smell, taste, touch, and feel. But senses themselves are very unsatisfactory and impermanent and very delusive. So just to rely on sensual objects, what you see or hear, smell, taste, touch, or think, or feel in the moment, it changes, it's very dependent on other conditions, on the weather, the time of day, who you're with, whether you're being praised or criticized. You know, your personal reactions to praise and blame. you know, so he can, this is a time where people are very, in modern life, liberal thinking is very open to trying to be politically correct, where we don't say things that offend people, because we're aware how strong words can be, racist slurs or sexist slurs or whatever, you know, we think this is not politically correct. So we try to, when we're in public, we try to be politically correct, follow the ideals of political correctness. But even being politically correct is still not the answer. It's just an intellectual exercise that we imagine that we can see the power of words, how they affect us, like being blamed for something or being praised, being ignored, being talked about behind your back. All these are part of a human experience. But it's all this sense of me and mine. It's my feelings, you don't just say anything to offend me. And when you're talking to me, be polite and respectful, because I'm a very senior monk. And according to this tradition, you should respect senior monks and be polite and use proper speech, right speech. This is very good advice. But it's still ideas that we tend to cling to. Cling to traditions, to thoughts, to precepts, to what we've been trained to believe is right or wrong, good or bad, true or false. So the way it is, it's not about it's wonderful or it's horrible or I don't know. It's like this. To me, this is like an opening, a wide open space of just being, rather than trying to figure out what the way it is in terms and politically correct terms. Or even in vulgar terms. So reflective awareness, like in daily life, you know, I live quite secluded from the rest of you and have a lot of time all by myself. And the way it is, you know, there's nothing happening, nothing kind of exciting or interesting. Look out at these glass doors on my kuti, which I can look out into the garden. Look at the barren trees and the rain falling, the way it is. But by developing this sense of open, wide awareness, it's not critical, it's not complaining about the weather, about being old or disabled. It's not a complaining state. It's not kind of trying to convince myself that everything is wonderful and I'm very happy, but it's like this, which doesn't need a description because it is the reality of here and now. Now this open, wide open emptiness It's silent. It doesn't have eyes, ears, nose, tongue. It doesn't have a brain. It's not about right and wrong anymore, or true or false. It's like this. And you begin to just relax and open to life rather than trying to always be busy doing things or distracting yourself or getting caught up with activities, chit-chatting, talking to others, using your iPhones, on and on like this are distractions from the way it is. Because wherever you are, whatever the time of day, it's always here and always now. So experience is now. And this wide open awareness, it's being here and now, rather than me trying to be here and now. Now we get the word, so I could think, I've got to practice being here and now. So I start from this that being here and now is something I've got to do, rather than just trust in just this wide open knowing, unknowing. It doesn't know anything. It doesn't need to know. It's rest. It's bliss in itself, because the self view is always caught up with becoming something, getting something you don't have, or getting rid of things you have you don't want. Now, this doesn't mean that I just sit with an empty mind looking out the window in my kuti. I have an iPad. I can surf with my iPad. I enjoy iPads, and I find reading difficult because of my vision. But the main practice is the wide open unknowingness of here and now, and just trusting, resting, relaxing, and being the witness to the restless tendencies that we feel through the senses, through the body. And I have pinned to the shrine on my desk a little notice that's saying, this wide open unknowingness is what I am, not something I know. So this is a good reminder. This wide open unknowingness is what I am, not something I know. So for us, knowing is defining, labeling, describing, limiting, being beautiful or ugly, right or wrong, good or bad, politically correct or wrong speech or vulgar statements. So these are all ways of defining what we've been conditioned to do with our brain, with our intellect, because it's conditioned. Languages are conditioned phenomena. You know, they're not eternal, trustworthy. When we try to define reality, define this wide open unknowingness with the words. You know, we can't find the words because the idea, you know, the self-view is, I want to know. What does he mean, this wide open unknowingness? That doesn't sound very tantalizing. What is it, Nibbana? That sounds pretty good. You know, is Ajahn Sumedho in Nibbana, or is he enlightened, or is he just empty, or is he a zombie? You know, so we try to imagine this wide open unknowingness, but it's here and now, and it's just like this. Silent, fully conscious. You're not closing your eyes or plugging up your ears or anything. You're not trying to destroy the senses, but you're no longer believing that sensual experience is the real world that we've been told it is. Because this is a time in history where it's very, very sensually exciting time. We can distract ourselves through so many wonderful inventions, technology. So this gives us every opportunity to learn about all kinds of things we wouldn't know about if we didn't have internet. We'd have to spend hours in library or the British Museum to find out about ancient cultures and other languages and on like that to get all the information. And then we're depending on authorities telling us what is the trustworthy text to read or what is rubbish. So we're told, you know, this is the right text, it's the understanding of Dhamma, it's a true representation of Buddhism, or we might think, somebody else might say, it's just rubbish, it's not true. So then, personally, we might lean towards this is the final text on defining Buddhism, or we might align ourselves with it's all rubbish. But we don't know. What is Buddhism? And so that's a question we can ask ourselves. And then we go to the Tripitaka, we go to the text on the internet, on YouTube, and on and on like that to find out what somebody tells you Buddhism is. But just the word Buddhism is just a sankhara and a condition that's created by human beings. So it's not dismissing it as rubbish or irrelevant, but it is impermanent, and that impermanence makes it unsatisfactory. Just, you know, the word Buddha or Dhamma or Sangha are words where wide open awareness, unknowingness here and now, isn't about Buddhism or Dhamma or right or wrong, true or false, but it's the reality of being that we oftentimes miss in our daily lives because we're always busy distracting ourselves, looking for something or getting caught up in all kinds of political views or modern views, religious views, cultural views, and on like that, so that we can entertain ourselves with the far right or the far left or the liberal or the conservative or how we want, what we tend to incline toward is very individual. I used to wonder why everybody didn't think like me. Because I have quite a liberal view of life as a person. So being brought up in the United States and the West Coast United States, my parents were very liberal and attitudes towards everything with modern life in California, very liberal, hedonistic experiences of experience life to the fullest, and all kinds of advice like that, follow your heart wherever it takes you. And I remember in Berkeley when I was a student there was the attitude of the prophet was follow your heart. And that appeals to liberal minds, because that sounds very appealing to a liberal-minded, conditioned mind. But then there's a very moralistic line that if you don't believe in God and you don't keep the moral precepts, you're going to hell. That is one way of being conditioned, that you're going to, if you commit a crime or you're adulterous, promiscuous, all things like that are wrong, and there's only the right forms of sexual activity, right forms of behavior that exclude drugs, alcohol, sex, and all the rest, where that's very rigid views of this is absolutely right and the other's absolutely wrong. Well, the liberal view is more kind of interesting, where the other is very kind of binding to you, to fear. If you're brought up in one of these very rigid religious views, then there's a lot to fear. You feel a lot of guilt. You're guilt-ridden and frightened. If you do something wrong, you're going to be punished severely for it. So fear is part of our experience through the thinking mind. When you think about the future, just thinking about climate change or the wars in the Middle East or in Ukraine and Russia, or you hear Iran is ready, it might start a third world war, or the United States. And these are very, how do they affect you, in the present moment, emotionally? War is something we don't want. It's something bad is, war is very bad, peace is very good. So then it's about right and wrong. Wars are justified. To go to war, you have to justify your reasons for it. And that takes more thinking, more kind of cogitating and proliferating in your thinking mind. But wide open unknowingness doesn't think. And it's here and now, and it's when you begin to trust it, learn to relax and open to the here and nows like this. That's what they call bliss. Now the word bliss in Berkeley in 1960 was blissed out on drugs, smoking pot or something, and you get blissed out. So bliss in my vocabulary meant something very high. you're just out of it, you know, you're blissed out, you're no longer caught in the mundane dreariness of daily life. Or that's a conditioned view of bliss, to be blissed out, or bliss, or is that, what is bliss in terms of reality? Because blissed out is very impermanent. And it makes you want more of the drugs and alcohol in order to stay blissed out. So it's very addictive. But bliss in terms of wide open unknowingness is very peaceful. And intellectually, we want peace rather than war. We demand that the governments have peaceful attitudes rather than warlike ones, and I was active in two peace movements in Berkeley in 1960, and I wanted peace because there was, in 1960 there was a big threat from Cuba. There was a fear of Russia was arming the Cuban island with missiles, and there was this incredible conflict going on. And I remember at the university, everybody was really frightened. So we wanted peace. We didn't want war. But peace, wide open unknowingness to the conditioned mind, to the intellect, is not very interesting. It's not exciting. Where war is exciting, murder is exciting, sex is exciting. These are exciting conditions. So excitement, you know, the conditioned realm can be very exciting or boring. We can get bored with the news that you hear on the BBC, or you can get bored with too much excitement. So the peace of wide open unknowingness can seem very boring. And boredom is a condition that arises and ceases. And in monastic life, so much of it is boring. Just chanting. Namo tassa bhagavato, where, you know, we kind of monotone chanting, where we'd like to, where operatic abilities to use your voice from going from a high tone to a low tone. And emotionally, it's, you know, it's rather exciting, emotional music. The daily routine, the schedule, the Vinaya precepts, the training rules, the standards of conduct for the monastery. We can learn all these, and they're very right and good and true, but also we can feel very bound by them. Very, you know, like we're caught in a trap of limitations. And I remember in the first year I was with Lungpa Cha in Wat Pa Pong, there was so much strict Vinaya being forced on me that I just felt incredibly suffocated by all these precepts. And I remember just feeling so bound and limited, and there was a sense of a rebelliousness or being critical, thinking it's over the top too much. So I began to, you know, I could see that no one was asking me to do anything bad. You know, they were all, a lot of the precepts, none of them are ask you to break, to do something wrong, commit a crime or break the precepts, but it's they are precepts, they're guidelines for living in a community, a sangha of Dharma practitioners. But Lumpa Cha's reflections on the way it is and being the witness to the way it is, I began to witness my conditioned attitude towards precepts, towards limited rules, towards moral precepts, towards being in a situation that I found both inspiring. I found Wat Pa Phong, life at Wat Pa Phong, inspiring, but also I felt suffocated. And just by opening to that feeling of being suffocated, it's like this, suddenly it vanished. The feeling of suffocation disappeared. Also, I was taking this very personally, the precepts, the instructions from the other monks, the constant reminders, the kind of being constantly reminded how to conduct myself. And, you know, I was a 31, 32-year-old man, I lived quite an independent life, and suddenly all these younger monks were telling me how to walk, how to carry my yam, how to sit, how to eat my food, how to do everything, and then the pride of a 32-year-old American of liberal conditioning was like this. You know, tried to buy the party line, you know, about this is right and this is the best monastery. I was quite willing to go along with that. Because I did admire the lifestyle at Wat Pa Phong and Lumpa Cha and the monks that I lived with there. So there is a kind of admiration. But also I had to deal with conditioning, personal conditioning, social, cultural conditioning. And so this is when we talk about Puto as a mantra. Or the witness, taking the witness position of Buddha, knowing Dhamma, then this is, you know, suddenly, you know, you realize witnessing is here and now. I can witness feeling suffocated. I can witness my critical mind, my resentment about being corrected. I could witness the feeling of being bound and caught in a trap. So that witness is not personal. It's mindfulness here and now awareness, conscious awareness, it's consciousness, wide open, unknowing consciousness that isn't operating, doesn't need the senses to exist because it is always here and now. It's the deathless reality of Nibbana. So doubt, like the third fetter of the ten fetters of Vichikicca, translated as doubt. Doubt is something to really witness. And before I ordained, or decided to ordain, I was working as an English language teacher in Bangkok, and I had a master's degree in Indian culture. I'd studied Hindi in Berkeley and studied Indian history, and I was very interested in the Gandhian movement, Mahatma Gandhi, and in yoga, and in Aurobindo, Sri Aurobindo, and in Ramakrishna, all these Indian saints and philosophers. And so I had a ticket, an air ticket from Bangkok to Calcutta. I repurchased it. But I was teaching English at Thammasat University, and I was practicing meditation at Wat Maha Thot, one of the main old Bangkok temples by the Grand Palace. So I realized I wanted to ordain, and the doubt came. Maybe I should go to India first and get that over with, and I could always come back to Thailand and ordain. So I had this ticket, airline ticket, and I was staying at the YMCA in Bangkok, and I'd go back to my room after teaching, and I'd anguish about, should I ordain or should I just go to India first? I could go to India and see what that's about, and investigate possibilities there before I decide on Thailand. And then I'd anguish in my room at the YMCA. I was anguishing about, what should I do? Should I go to India or should I just ordain? Or where should I ordain? And I was caught in this. I was lying on my bed in an anguished state of not knowing what to do. And then something in her voice came forth and said, shut up and ordain. So I did. What is that inner voice? I don't know. Is it mine? Is it some guardian angel or deva? But it wasn't through trying to figure out what to do, because that just left me in a state of doubt and anguish, because both opportunities were appealing, ordaining or going to India. They both had their appeal, you know, and intellectually I was fighting with my intellect about what was right, what do I really need, and to justify going to India, certainly a good reason to go, and then ordaining, and then the inner voice that wasn't from the intellect, wasn't me deciding anything, it just came up, said, shut up and ordain. So that was, you know, just to share my experiences with doubt, with should I do this or should I do that? Should I go to India or should I stay in Thailand? Trying to figure out how what you should do in the future, you can be a witness to just by witnessing this doubting uncertainty of what to do, what's right, what do I need personally for my own growth, my development. Well, at that time, I wasn't really consciously aware of what I really needed. But something about ordaining is something that I had considered seriously for a long time, even before I ever went to Thailand. And so, I liked the idea of a religious community. And so I was really keen on finding, you know, I remember at the University of California libraries, graduate students had their own desks, permanent desks, and mine was on the 9th tier of this incredible library where they had all the books on holy men and Indian teachers and yoga. And I used to look at these books of yogis hanging from trees or covered in ashes. And I kept thinking, maybe I should try something like that. Become a naked ascetic in India. Cover myself with ashes or learn to hang from a tree or stand still just the idea of asceticism was quite appealing to me. Because I had this kind of romantic image of this life, holy life, as being something where you gave up everything and you really challenged your senses. Where in my life in Berkeley was smoking pot, drinking beer, and even though that was quite pleasant and enjoyable, it didn't lead me anywhere. It left me just feeling life is kind of pointless, meaningless. If this is what I'm going to do the rest of my life. So where the holy life seemed very, very romantic and very, you know, what I wanted to do. So then the opportunity to ordain in Thailand, I liked Thailand. Thailand's a very friendly, welcoming country, nice and warm. So there are good reasons to stay in Thailand and also good reasons to go and tour India. But then this wide open unknowingness wasn't a conscious decision that I just made suddenly, choosing one over the other. It just came from something that I couldn't identify with. So I've never regretted that. In all these years as a Buddhist monk, I've never regretted ordaining as a Buddhist monk back in 1966. But this wide open unknowingness or bliss, remember, your ego is a conditioned thing. the sense of self, of me and mine, it's very believable because we're programmed to think always in terms of me, what I think, my view, my body, my feelings, my life. And not that that's wrong or even right, but it's how we're conditioned. So the conditioning is something programmed onto us when we're growing up, when we're born. We're quite innocent, unconditioned, conscious forms. And we learn to develop, if we're brought up in a very strict evangelical Christian community where there's so much fear and demand on absolute right and absolute wrong, heaven and hell, God and the devil, then that's conditioning. That's the conditioning you get when you're still very innocent, unknowing child. Or then you may be brought up in a family where they're smoking pot, drinking alcohol, and carrying on, and you get no kind of conditioning except survival instincts. Learning to survive in a kind of free lifestyle that you're not, because when you're innocent, you don't know what to do or where, you don't know the limits of behavior. So children are always pushing the limits of their parents just to test them out, see how far to go before they stop. Because they don't know. So conditioning is about precepts, and the precepts for the monastic precepts, the samana precepts, are ways of training oneself in terms of action, physical action and speech. They're not absolute right and wrong, or if you break one of the precepts, you'll go to hell, or you'll something terrible will happen, or you'll be reborn in a low state. Don't believe any of that. That's just make believe. But they're guidelines that you can use to limit action and speech in a gentle way, rather than in a harsh, absolute right and wrong, punishment, reward and punishment style. So bliss then is peace. And it's here and now. It's not something you'll ever get from conditioning as a separate person, because the personality is conditioned, and it's a restless form. It's so concerned about what people think of me, or my rights, or my position, or my status, or life for even the most wealthy, fortunate human beings is still caught up in all these social problems, because even with all the money in the world, it's still the basic problem is ignorance of Dhamma, the open unknowingness here and now, the way it is, which is very simple. But it's not easy, because the conditioning is very complicated. You really can't help. You didn't ask for the conditioning you got. You just got what was available. A little baby just is open to, just like a sponge, it just absorbs whatever comes toward it. So you don't ask for it, you don't choose it, but it's what you get. So in bhavana, or meditation, we open ourselves to these conditioning, these conditions, good ones or righteous ones or bad ones, wrong ones. We all can have traumas in our life, emotional traumas, misunderstandings. Life is about, it's very traumatic, the experience of a person on planet Earth. It's a traumatic experience. But as we open to the Dhamma, open our knowingness here and now, we begin to see our real refuge is in the bliss of silence, relaxed awareness, witnessing, not judging, not evaluating, not qualifying, but learning to just trust here and now is like this. And then you begin to see your conditioning arise and go. You know, it just, all your fears will arise, and then if you're patient, you know, then fears disappear. They don't stay. Your sense of being abused or misunderstood arises in this kind of meditation because you're conditioned to feel like this, but it arises and ceases. And in the cessation, it's peace. And in the poet Shelley, the funeral of Keats, when the English poet Keats passed away, the poet Shelley, who's a friend of Keats, wrote a very interesting poem called Adonais, and it's the first stanzas are, "Peace, peace, he is not dead, he doth not sleep. He has awakened from the dream of life." So this is what meditation is, awakening from the dream of life. So I offer this as a reflection.